spectators, cruelly impelled to perform the rugged labor of a prison chain gang. My assorted flesh wounds and contusions sang with painful delight at being alive. These hands would live another day to be brutally used again by the asshole operating the soap. I emerged, freshly scrubbed, and headed straight for the large dining table, where I was reacquainted with Helen and one-year-old Tom, who continued to delight and terrify, depending on the direction of the breeze. With the other children at school, he ruled the roost, and I spoke to him of mischief, namely that he and I might get up to some, if not now, then one day soon. He cackled conspiratorially, saluting with his spoon, and nailed me with an open-mouthed wink. Sometimes, even at the tender age of one, a person can communicate so clearly that they will be my leader, and I understand with a clarity that could not be more obvious. They are the general in whose army I have the pleasure of serving. I have a niece who does this as well. God help us if she ever gets together with Tom. What a marvelous day I was having, and it was only just lunchtime. The earlier mention I made of a pleasurable assault on the senses was about to peak. Helen brought to the table a pot from the stove to finish off the preparation of, and I might suggest you say this out loud with me, ham and bean broth and fresh-baked bread and butter. Let's keep cool. Deep inhale through the nose. Let it out through the ham hole. I mean. Now, you might understand my earlier comment. The colder and wetter you can stand it outside, the more goddamn amazing the ham and bean broth is gonna go down. While the scene I'm sketching took place in the UK, it couldn't help but remind me of the very American journey I'd been taking back at home, and of Wendell's question, and of the fellow he had mentioned, Aldo Leopold. Since that time, and even today, I've been perusing Leopold's legend and his own territory, my own beloved Midwest. I can scarcely imagine a better location for the rearing of a future agrarian legend than where Aldo sprung from, the forested bluffs of Iowa, overlooking the Mississippi River. Similar to James and myself, Aldo Leopold had the benefit of a dad who took him to the woods and taught him the ways of woodcraft, to look and see what was there, and to discern how he might make use of it. Young Leopold became a skilled hunter and observer as he explored the environs of Iowa and Illinois on their respective banks of that mighty river. Similarly to our 26th president, Theodore Roosevelt, remember him, Leopold spent an impressive amount of time cataloging the local bird populations in his area. This fascination with the forest and the creatures inhabiting it led him to pursue his secondary education at Yale's brand new School for Forestry, founded, not so coincidentally, by Gifford Pinchot, a contemporary of Roosevelt, Grinnell, and John Muir, whom we met earlier. In 1905, at the dawning of the 20th century, Leopold worked diligently to be accepted into the nascent forestry program. And despite his tendency to spend more time in the woods around New Haven, Connecticut than in the classroom, he managed to survive the indoor portions of his schooling well enough to achieve his goal of being hired by the U.S. Forest Service by 1909. His first postings were in the territories of Arizona and New Mexico, both on the verge of achieving statehood in 1912. First at the Apache National Forest, then the Carson National Forest, Leopold brought his lifelong curiosity to bear, and he developed a substantial comprehension of the area's flora and fauna. When I read Forest Service, it makes me think mainly of ranger stations and Smoky Bear, and log cabin-style fire lookout towers. But this governmental agency within the U.S. Department of Agriculture is, of course, much more complex than that when it comes to its responsibilities. This was even more the case in Leopold's day, when the service oversaw areas of concern that were later split off into other sub-agencies, like the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Thus, the Forest Service bore the responsibility for managing fishing and hunting and the growing packs of humans in search of recreation in the newly formed parks and wilderness preserves of the annexed southwestern states. Aldo Leopold was tasked with writing the first Game and Fish Handbook for the Forest Service and developing the first comprehensive management plan for no lesser an attraction than the Grand Canyon. Another of the departmental duties in which Leopold took part was the dogged eradication of the apex predators, which were the bane of local Southwest ranchers. Bears, mountain lions, and wolves were hunted and destroyed on sight, not just for the beef and sheep concerns, but for the sake of game hunters as well. Stone walls may have kept the English country sheep safe enough, but not so in the American West. In his essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, Leopold details an epiphany that came about as the result of one such wolf extermination that he undertook with companions. They were eating lunch when they saw a she-wolf and some pups downhill from them. They immediately began firing at the wolves, for, as he wrote, in those days we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. He went on, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then, and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." The realization he referred to fully turned his thinking around in a way that came to shape not only the remainder of his life and career, but his entire agrarian position that our civilization is still in desperate need of implementing. When he wrote that the mountain wouldn't agree with the violent, self-centered habits of mankind, what he meant was that by eradicating the wolves in this case, the deer would then be allowed to proliferate beyond the balance that had heretofore been maintained by the natural order of things. One direct result of this surplus deer population would be the denuding of the mountain, when too many deer would eat every leaf and shoot on every plant, from the ground to, quote, the height of a saddle horn, which would result in nothing but, in the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleach with the bones of the dead sage, or molder under the high-lined junipers. In witnessing the dying green fire in that she-wolf's eyes, Leopold awoke to the wisdom of thinking like the mountain. He saw at once how our species is merely one small part of the great economy that is all of nature, and the ecological humility that our place in nature subsequently requires. This attitude fell in stark contrast to the much more popular stance that mankind had assumed over the ages, one to which we are yet tenaciously clinging. It has been so powerfully our brand for so long a time that even 2,500-odd years ago, our Greek dramatists recognized the folly therein and gave this singularly human characteristic a cool name, hubris. The essence of the hubris in this case is humankind's inability to comprehend that we do not know and never can know, as Wendell Berry tells it, Either all the creatures that the kingdom of God contains, or the whole pattern or order by which it contains them. This was Aldo Leopold's revelation, one that would steer him to introduce more benevolent, eco-conscious policies in the wildlife management of the Southwest, a spiritual shift that eventually, decades later, would see the bear and wolf populations restored to the mountains of New Mexico. His new, clear-eyed principles were founded in a reasoned humility in the face of nature. This set him apart from the totalitarian sensibilities of his peer conservationists, who thought that the natural resources of this planet were to be exploited first and foremost as humankind saw fit. It has ever been the attitude of us Homo sapiens that when we employ our appetites and our technology to take what we like from the earth, if that greed should cause us any sort of problem, why, we'll just use our indefatigable smarts to science us up a solution to that new problem. And if that creates more problems, that's no sweat, because Silicon Valley has a hella slick new algorithm that will steer us above the pesky issues of pollution and the extinction of, quote, unneeded species. Leopold now understood that the only way to live responsibly, with the values of good citizenship in regard to our planet, our watershed, our neighbors, and ourselves, was to understand our place in that infinite pattern, to humbly acknowledge the inscrutability of Mother Nature's grocery list, and therefore remain ever vigilant about respecting our place upon it. And that day in the Rebanks household, I seemed to have found the modern equivalent of what Aldo Leopold was searching for. Once my thin-blooded California candy ass had recovered from the conditions that James and Helen considered simply normal, I got a tour of their digs. The majority of the house was a post-and-beam structure that had been retrofitted into a two-story stone barn that had been built on the property in the 1870s. With decorative carvings of faces in the ends of the oak beams, and bespoke touches like a beautifully dovetailed custom surround housing the exhaust hood above the stove, all done by a couple of local joiners, the Rebankses had given themselves the gift of their dream house only a few years earlier. For his whole life, James had held the stone sheep barn in that special fantasy space that can be so fruitfully decorated by a child's imagination. Improbably, he'd always thought, how amazing it would be to one day turn that barn into my house. But of course, things like that don't happen in reality because they are neither physically practical nor fiscally responsible. Fortunately for this family, however, they don't need to reside entirely within the walls of reality, because Dad happens to have written some hit books. This storybook house must powerfully satisfy not only James and Helen and their in-house troupe of wee hired hands, but also generation upon generation of their mildly itinerant ancestors, scratching a posthumous housing itch that likely dates back many centuries. According to James, their sheep have been bred to graze that mountain, hefted to the fell, since at least the first century, when the Vikings were the ones buying packets of crisps at the pub. The Herdwick breed may, in fact, be traceable to the first farmers in the region around 4,500 years ago. So, although James's family has been bouncing around the Matterdale area since 1420, sometimes renting and sometimes owning land and houses, there has never been one long-term family home. Like so many families then and now, working shoulder to the wheel, year in and year out, the Rebanks clan moved from home to home, just keeping a step ahead of the landlord and the tax man. In much the same way that my acting career affords me a nicer shop of tools than if I were a woodworker only, James's writing success has augmented his intense shepherding life. Despite the prowess he wields at the sheep auction, winning prizes and commanding high prices, it took the extra frosting of a best-selling book to pull off this truly storybook house. On top of the charming construction, the young parents also rigged the farm with a solar panel and lithium battery array for electricity, with a generator for when the occasional backup is needed. Heating is mainly accomplished with burning wood and heating oil. And in the meantime, his flock has also increased. All in all, it's a pretty impressive success story, from the 20 Herdwick ewes with which they started in 2002, they have grown their flock to 300 good ewes, or, as George Clinton calls them, mother sheep. Kids, this joke is from the 70s. This house required a keen imagination, the zeal of the homesteader, and a healthy dash of whimsy. Some people might call this extravagance irresponsible or stupid. I say it's gorgeous. It's romantic and brimming with life. Laughter abounds throughout the rooms, and some unhappy caterwauling as well, although thankfully much more the former. The key to making this playfully conceived house vital instead of a folly is that it is being used. Utilized to within an inch of its life. Like the stones in the pasture wall were prized for their utility, everything about this warm and welcoming shelter is being properly exploited, and it was a joy to witness. Once we had braced ourselves with plenty of stew and a cup of ubiquitous tea, black for me, it was back out into the weather to check on the flocks. We saw the ewes, the ladies, the tup hogs, the young fellows, and the tups, the patriarchs. I helped James distribute sheep cake, which sounds really yummy, but don't get excited. It's like large, nutritious kibble for sheep, and nothing like cake whatsoever. I was pissed. The sheep came running from the far corners of the hillside pasture when James called for them, because I guess they also thought there was actual cake. They seemed not as miffed as I was, however, at the bait and switch, and happily munched the nuggets on the ground. I couldn't help but marvel at the majestic alpine appearance of these simple creatures, which had been perfectly adapted over the millennia to survive with perfect equanimity in the freezing rains and snow of northern English winters. James and his neighbors were adhering to the tried and true agricultural practice of pairing the beast with the place. If your animals are genetically equipped to thrive in their environment from the get-go, well, think about it. Do the math, and you'll find they will require much less expense in every direction. If you can stay out of Mother Nature's way as much as possible, year after year, it stands to reason that your harvest of her bounty will have a much better chance at consistently high quality. This method contrasts pretty starkly with the American ideal, not of agriculture, but of agribusiness. In that methodology, you can generally ignore the nature of the place while proceeding to maximize your output at all costs, including the cost of much lower quality produce. The reason you needn't worry about the problems nature might hand you, bugs, weeds, depleted soil, malnutrition, etc., is because any problems can be eradicated through the use of chemicals and machinery. Of course, these solutions invariably create more problems, especially since nothing grows in a vacuum. That's how cancer-causing herbicides like Roundup from the giant corporation Monsanto end up in the runoff of every watershed in the country, or entire communities end up with chronic pollution and blight. The solutions from agribusiness might kill a weed or even all weeds, but the scorecard never ends there. Like all human problems, the situation is more complicated than just big farm bad, little farm good. But in the grand scheme of American food production, my attention is consistently drawn to one massive factor. The vast majority of our grain farmers are not actually growing edible food. Instead of working within the parameters of nature, also known as health, to produce delicious, nutritious food items, all of the corn and soybeans are destined to become mere ingredients, processed into food products in a factory setting. His adherence to the old ways is primarily what drew me to James in the first place. One of the central themes in his writing has to do with recognizing the mistakes we humans have made with regard to farming decisions over the last few generations, and undertaking a program of action to reverse the damage that we have exacted upon our lands, our climate, our animals, and ourselves, upon nature. Maybe this is also part of what Wendell meant in his Muir versus Leopold idea, observing not just what farmers like James were doing to prevent further damage, but what they were doing to reverse the mistakes made in the past, and to restore the harmony that both the people and the land ultimately deserve. That's a hell of a task that will require the efforts and votes of many more people than just well-meaning agrarians. Our industrial food system, especially in the U.S., is an enormous machine in which we have invested decades of wealth and ingenuity, fortifying ourselves in the wrong direction, it turns out. It's a notion that has always fascinated me, ever since I started reading Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser. We have allowed our food system to be entirely usurped by corporate interests who do not produce our food with our health in mind. Think about that. I mean, what is the point of food in the first place? In America, the obfuscation cloaking how our food is produced has reached the point where we have to work hard just to discern which food is actually clean, healthy, nutritious, and free of additives, and then pay considerably more to buy it. By the way, I should point out that the farmers themselves, from large to small, are not the villains here, but simply participants in a deeply flawed system that is perpetuated by faceless corporate entities. Farming successfully on any level is extremely difficult. My very own family members farm corn and soybeans, and they are as hardworking and decent of people as any I have ever met. I have admired my uncles and cousins and their farming households my entire life for the self-sufficient way that they are able to look at the available options, the fields, the crops, the equipment, the market, and wrestle a profit out of them damn near every year. On this topic, I usually get in over my head pretty quickly, so I called my friend Mary Berry, lioness daughter of Wendell and Tanya, baker of brown sugar pies, who has picked up the ball of the family ethos, if you will, and is running like hell for the end zone. In the small town of Newcastle, Kentucky, she runs the Berry Center and also sits on the board of the Wendell Berry Farming Program, a relatively young venture in partnership with Vermont's Sterling College, educating young farmers in the ways they might navigate the extremely difficult waters of modern agriculture in this country. One of the founding principles of the aforementioned Berry ethos was the Burley Tobacco Program, written and legislated into being by Wendell's father, John M. Berry Sr., a farmer and lawyer. The program created a cooperative, which included small, diversified tobacco farmers in the 8-state Burley Belt. In one of only a few examples of such level dealing in our history, the program took control of production in order to maintain a parity price, equal for all growers, and eventually applied this parity principle to all of their farming output, ensuring that the farmers had a financial backstop in place. Small holdings farmers were then able to make farm payments and borrow funds to transition from farm tenancy to ownership. Land and the imperative culture of good land use thus passed fairly seamlessly from generation to generation. This sensibility makes me long to elect Mary to the highest agricultural office to which we can vault her, as she brings the accumulated wisdom and experience of a few generations of thinking berries to bear on the current dilemmas facing farmers. When I asked her about it, she set me straight that this subject, too, requires a great deal more nuance. She said, "It is important to say that we have given farmers in this country two choices. They can be small and entrepreneurial or large and industrial. There's almost nothing for the middle where most of our farmers, people who live from farming, are. We are losing these farmers faster than very small farmers or very large ones. In these mid-sized farmers lives much of what is left of an agrarian culture. Some farmers have tried and succeeded in the world of entrepreneurial farming, but many have failed, and it has not built the kind of agricultural community that supports good farming. Entrepreneurial farmers are in direct competition with each other. Many of our farmers have gotten into the grain economy and either failed completely or have kept themselves afloat on debt. Meanwhile, our economy keeps humming along as if the destruction of our land and our people can go on forever, and we will continue to eat. I propose that we consider our farmers on a spectrum, let's say, of agrarianism. On one end of the spectrum, we have farmers like James, interested in producing the finest foodstuffs that they can, given the soil, the climate, the water, the budget, and their talent. They observe how efficacious or not their efforts are proving, and they adapt accordingly. Variety is one of the keys to this technique, eschewing the corporate monocultures for a revolving set of plants and animals, again, to mimic what was already happening on the land before we showed up with our earth-shaving machinery. It's tough as hell, and in many cases impossible to farm this way and earn enough profit to keep your bills paid and your family fed, but these farmers do exist. On the other end of the spectrum is full-speed-ahead robo-farming, in which the farmer is following the instructions of the corporation to produce not food, but commodities, in such a way that the corporation sits poised to make the maximum financial profit. Now, this is the part that has always fascinated me about us as a population. This kind of farmer is doing all they can to make their factory quota for the company, of grain or meat or what have you, despite their soil, climate, water, budget, or talent. It only stands to reason that this methodology is the very definition of unsustainable. Clearly, this is an oversimplification of an issue that requires as much of my refrain, nuance, as any other human endeavor. But the broad strokes are hard to refute. The first farmer is doing their best to work with nature. The second farmer is doing their best despite nature. In order for the second farmer to prosper, they must defeat nature. A great example of this is the factory farming of beef, pork, chicken, eggs, turkey, salmon, etc. The manufacturers of these products have done everything they can to take the process out of nature entirely and hide it in a shed, where every step of the production has been engineered to make a profit, to excel at quantity. I know you're a little bit ahead of me here, but I'll go ahead and ask the obvious question. What of quality? If you're willing to degrade these many lives with impunity, the lives of the animals themselves, the workers growing them, the neighbors having to suffer the voluminous poisons being pumped into the ecosystem and watershed, and the humans consuming your products, then what are you about? Can that even be considered farming? Again, I'm asking this of us, of you and me, because what I have just described is the way a lot of our food is produced right now, in the system that we all support with our dollars. How did we get here, in both the U.S. and the U.K.? How can we change our national stance toward agriculture to accommodate more middle-sized farmers and less factory farms? How would Aldo Leopold feel about it? Chapter 10. Manchester. When I arrived via train back in Manchester after my first few days and nights with the Rebanks family, I began to see the city through new eyes. Barreling through the picturesque white wintry hills, which were outlined by the very stone walls which I had newly become a master at building, master only compared to the other actors, please don't tell James I called myself this. He'll rightly tell you that my side of the wall was rubbish. I began to feel the minor oppression that comes with re-entry into the gray urban landscape of England's fifth largest city. Disembarking into the bustling crowd of Manchester Piccadilly Station, I felt a bit melancholy, as though I had been feeding sheep with Peter Pan on the fells of Neverland, and now I had to return to the cold modern world of responsibility, dictated by the machinery of humankind on computers, in cubicles, in office buildings which loom over the sharp right angles of the streets, sidewalks, and curbs. Working in Manchester on the Alex Garland show Devs was actually not my first sojourn in the historic birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. 5 years earlier, I had been staying in London with my heroic wife, Megan, as she filmed a television show, and I took the train one day a few hours north to Manchester to see my longtime favorite band. They just happened to be called Wilco and were fronted by my favorite extreme balls-to-the-walls survivalist adventure and yours too, singer-songwriter-mountaineer Jeff Tweedy. Back in 2014, I had been obsessed with Wilco for almost 2 decades, but my friendship with Jeff himself was still new. As a result, I was trembling with the excitement of a kid on Christmas morning at the prospect of seeing him and them. Living in a swanky hotel in Soho and kicking around London, learning to speak Cockney with the other chimney sweeps was thrilling enough, but then to have my rock and roll mate casually ask if I wanted to come see them in Manchester was far beyond what any boy could be expected to withstand. It was as though I were just chilling with Peter Gabriel and Zadie Smith, maybe heading to the seaside for some proper fish and chips and newspaper, suggesting to him some new djembe beats, or telling her some terrific puns I had easily thought up. When I saw Jeff and the band, recited with ragged fervor, John, Nels, hee-hee, Glenn, Pat, Michael, but ha-ha, who's counting, rock my world that night at Manchester's historic Ritz Theater, now the O2 Ritz, I had no way of knowing that the city would come to play a substantial role in a future life chapter for me, but it was still thrilling enough. A couple hours before the show began, Jeff was alone on stage in this 100-year-old former dance hall with a sprung wooden jitterbug floor, and I was alone in the audience section, watching and hearing him soundcheck as the lighting designer ran through his cues. That means that randomly colored and patterned rock and roll lights played moodily across, above, and behind Jeff as he noodled a few Neil Young songs out of his booming J200 guitar, a handsome vintage chap called Buck. I've already written about Jeff's cover of The Losing End. I featured Jeff in my 2015 book Gumption, but he also played Pocahontas and Thrasher, two great examples of Neil Young's most powerful poetry. I remember these because the chords are quite manageable, which is a profound gift if you're a fan of Neil and you happen to be trying to learn to play the guitar. Both songs feature themes that ring through a lot of the questions that Jeff and I, and George with us, remember George, ask of ourselves and of society as we proceed to each hoe our own particular row. The subjects also flow through this book. examining the loss that has accompanied so many of our supposed gains in modern civilization. Pocahontas paints a bleak picture of our historically warlike treatment of Native Americans, complete with teepee murders, cut-down women, and babies crying on the ground. Young juxtaposes this imagery with talk of Hollywood and the Houston Astrodome, two representations of the material excess worshipped by Americans in the 1970s, when the song was written, contrasting the peaceful simplicity of the aurora borealis and paddles cutting the water with the schlocky, superficial institutions that replaced them. In Thrasher, the narrator is a free thinker who awakens to the fact that the people around him have become complacent sheep, lulled into a stupor by the affluence of consumerism. As Aldo Leopold wrote, "The modern dogma is comfort at any cost." Having devoted themselves wholly to modern materialism, the narrator's friends have grown calcified in the dissatisfying ruts of their urban lives. They had the best selection. They were poisoned with protection. There was nothing that they needed, nothing left to find. They were lost in rock formations, or became park bench mutations. On the sidewalks and in the stations, they were waiting. Waiting. He leaves them behind in an attempt to return to the purer ideals of yesteryear, more in line with the beauty and wisdom of nature's systems. The actual harbinger of the industrial doom in the song is the titular thrasher, a field grain-harvesting machine and forerunner to the modern grain combine, which is the precise chariot in which corporate agribusiness has lain waste to the grasslands of Aldo Leopold's Midwest. Writing this, I am reminded of Wendell Berry's essay, Two Economies, a 15-page gift of sagacity which posits the small economies in our lives, like those of your household, or of Decatur, Illinois, or the nation of Norway, or the money economy, also known as Wall Street, against the great economy of the universe, that of all creation, which I feel I can safely equate simply with nature. With his trademark common sense, Berry points up the futility in concerning ourselves solely with any one or more of these little economies, as though they don't all exist within and as a part of the great economy, whether we care to admit it or not. You may have noticed this sense of futility on occasion, when you have read or heard in the news that the economy is doing great, while you look around and see homelessness, sickness, and poverty as ever on the rise. The economy, in the news, has a lot to do with how the nation's corporations are faring, and little to do with how many salmon are managing to make it back up an Oregon River to their spawning grounds in the face of new dams we have installed. The little money economy that our politicians and bankers openly worship is not the economy about which we should be seeking diagnoses. The great economy, in the end, is all that matters. So perhaps my analogy was inapt when I wrote that leaving the Rebanks farm and entering Manchester felt like I was leaving the land of play to return to cold adult responsibility. Because what we have overwhelmingly forgotten as a population is exactly the responsibility of care that each of us owes to the great economy, and the lessons in that particular course of education that had damn better well be grown up are much more easily digested on a sheep farm than on the streets of a city. Thinking back on all of my trips to the Rebanks farm, as well as what I've been lucky enough to read of his writing, I'm struck by the frank humility with which James writes about the farming efforts made in his neighborhood by the last few generations that turned out to be erroneous in the end. These decisions were not taken lightly, by men and women whom James respected and at whose heels he studied. An important fuel for this catalog of mistakes has been our human propensity for hubris. Feeling the rush of blood and pride, when the Industrial Revolution began to turn the objectives of the working class upside down, James's ancestors, along with most of Western civilization, forgot the fealty that we must pay to Mother Nature, deciding instead that mankind could overpower nature with the might of our science and technology. In the case of the Rebanks Farm, for example, natural waterways were straightened into canal-like channels, ostensibly to increase and improve the acreage of the bottomlands via more efficient drainage. A few generations later, the land was still swampy and relatively unproductive, and a vast swath of biodiversity had disappeared, or at least been greatly diminished, sacrificed in the eradication of the natural creek-like becks. With the loss of the minnows, frogs, and scores of insects that swarmed around a small stream, their predators then also faded away, including entire species of birds and small mammals. Similarly, the once kaleidoscopic mix of grasses, thistles, and wildflowers in the pastures had long since been supplanted with much more homogenized monogrowth, with the idea that this would be more efficient for the feeding of the grazing ruminants. Again, the insects went away, the birds and bats that ate those insects went away, and the mowing of said monocrops presented a whole new treachery to species like the curlew, which traditionally nests on the ground in those wild grasses. The curlew, a charismatic relative of the plover and the sandpiper with a sweet song, all but disappeared in recent decades. Though with the kind attentions of farmers like the Rebanks family, they are slowly beginning to mount a comeback. This curlew dilemma reminds me of the great spotted owl debate of the 1980s in the Pacific Northwest. The United States Forest Service turned in a logging plan for old-growth forests that would essentially wipe out the entire population of spotted owls, who rely exclusively on that forest for their habitat. In a prolonged battle that grew quite rancorous, a compromise was reached that, of course, favored the money. The number of breeding pairs of these owls has since been drastically reduced, so that the species remains categorized as threatened on the endangered species list. Yet again, we humans looked at a vital part of an ecosystem and said, sure, we get it, we love the owls, but money. The cynical modern response, or at least the American response to such an issue, is who cares? It's an owl, boo-hoo, what's the big deal? Ha, you fell into my trap. Because after the dying wolf in the Green Fire incident turned Aldo Leopold's worldview around, he began to see every part of his Wisconsin farm as equally imperative to the overall health of the great economy. I quote, "The last word in ignorance is the man who says of an animal or plant, what good is it? If the land mechanism as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. If the biota, in the course of eons, has built something we like but do not understand, then who but a fool would discard seemingly useless parts? To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." Guess you feel pretty dumb now, huh, Mr. Moneybags Logger Guy? There's one major cog that we as a people have relegated to the literal dustbin because we have come to be taught that it's dirty. Let's talk about soil. Healthy soil. Loamy, moist, cakey soil, lousy with fecundity. If we were walking in an ideal field in Leopold's Madison or Rebanks's Cumbria, I might kneel down and scoop up a teaspoon of the stuff and say to you, augustly, You know how much microbial life is teeming in this teaspoon of soil? An ass load. Productive soil will usually contain between 100 million and 1 billion bacteria per teaspoon. That's a lot, like an ass load. Perhaps it's easier to picture thus. If you took the bacteria from 1 acre of good soil and mushed it together like Play-Doh, you could shape it into 2 good-sized cows. Here is an amazing description by Wendell Berry, and I'll let you decide who presented the facts more eloquently, me or this august man of letters. The soil is the great connector of lives, the source and destination of all. It is the healer and restorer and resurrector, by which disease passes into health, age into youth, death into life. Without proper care for it, we could have no community, because without proper care for it, we can have no life. Okay, I agree. It's a tie. But once more, for those in the back row, without proper care for our soil, we can have no life. Back to the train station in Manchester, and a refresher on some more human nuance. Because Manchester and what we have done there, and subsequently elsewhere, is also amazing and damn worthy of celebration. The Industrial Revolution started in Manchester, and for all the bad-mouthing I do about gross materialism, here comes the nuance. I am simply apeshit about all of the amazing crap we humans have made via the Industrial Revolution. I would have to be a fool not to be enthralled by my affordable blue denim jean pants, made possible by the sewing machine. Awesome. And, oh, sweatshop labor in Asia. Shit. I powerfully adore my Ford F-250 diesel Super Duty truck, mainly for hauling massive stacks of entire slabs of tree trunks up and down the West Coast to be made into furniture and boats and such in my wood shop, thanks to Henry Ford and his factory assembly line system. So dope! Unfortunately, my truck's emissions are part of the human dipshittery, contributing voluminously to climate change. Nuance, goddammit. Also, on top of his amazing contributions to industry, Henry Ford was also a vicious racist and anti-Semite. Son of a bitch. So as you can see, our consumption-mad society is a really mixed bag, morality-wise. I find it easy to envision and comprehend the haste with which we as a people turned our gaze from the health of the soil and the great economy overall to whatever the manufacturers had created to sell us. I imagine myself as a youngster in my dad's garden, pulling weeds, and staring, again puzzled, at the kohlrabi. What the F is it, anyway? When the salespeople drive up, in this fantasy they're in a PT Cruiser, and holler, "Hey Nick, do you want to kneel in the dirt like a hayseed, or do you want to come check out this new little amusement that we're calling Donkey Kong?" Now, I don't know about you, but I am certainly not man enough to resist a brand new video game, garden-side or not, because of how I'm goddamn stupid, you see. And I think you might be as well. No offense, it's part of our charm. We come by it honest, anyway. Manchester started things booming with textile machinery, namely the cotton mill. And by 1800, the city was said to be steam mill mad. Wool and cotton goods were only the beginning of a true global revolution of industry, at the center of which sat Manchester. Soon, across the early 19th century, the city was mass-producing goods of all descriptions. Pretty amazing, right? A source of immense pride. A pinnacle of human achievement. And rightfully so. Oh. Hang on. Shit. Where was that cotton coming from in this burgeoning global network? And who was picking it on the business end of an American bullwhip? Damn it. It's almost as though this insouciant nuance permeates every aspect of human endeavor. One of the absolute stars of the Industrial Revolution was, of course, the choo-choo train, the invention of rail travel. The Manchester Science and Industry Museum, a wonderful establishment housed in a collection of old warehouse buildings, including the original station for the world's oldest surviving passenger railway, had a great deal of proud information surrounding the steam locomotive Traveling Engine No. 19, more commonly known by her showbiz name, Rocket. This marvel of engineering was the favored vehicle developed for the nascent Liverpool and Manchester Railway, which was a pretty damn exciting new way to get around. Imagine riding behind a locomotive in a time when the only other forms of conveyance were fueled by either wind or horse. It was sincerely mind-blowing. A local luminary, Dr. James Johnson, was unnerved by the deafening peal of thunder, the sudden immersion in gloom, and the clash of reverberated sounds in confined space. Whilst nubile Covent Garden actress Fanny Kemble was awestruck, referring to the locomotives as tame dragons, and saying, "When I close my eyes, the sensation of flying was quite delightful and strange beyond description. Yet strange as it was, I had a perfect sense of security and not the slightest fear." Sounds a lot like the way I felt myself, riding the tame dragon to Manchester to catch a Wilco show, although I don't believe I've ever been described as nubile. Ursine, you bet. Nubile? Don't think so. Before the railways revolutionized freight haulage, when it was time for breeders to sell their flocks and herds at market, previous centuries saw drovers literally walking their livestock to the city, which sometimes meant trekking hundreds of miles to claim the best prices. Drovers would hoof it from the highlands of Scotland or the remote Welsh coast all the way to London to sell their beasts. This tradition had its hardships, but it also held certain charms for the people involved. Local customs and idioms were exchanged as the drovers came through, fostering a more well-rounded knowledge of the disparate parts of the island. Breeders were able to learn from one another what was and wasn't working with their breeds, thus improving the overall quality of their stock, with a proper sense of community. James told me that sometimes the drovers would catch a ride back to the farm, leaving their dogs on their own, because those sheepdogs were so smart that they would find their own way home, pub by pub. Not only was this amazing, but the pub owners would recognize these dogs and feed them, adding their fodder to the drovers' tabs for when they next returned. This is charming as hell, and it's just one tiny detail of all that is lost when we mechanize any process that used to rely on the knowledge and skill of human hands or feet. When expansive fields of grain on the American prairie are farmed entirely by machine, in a way that never once requires the farmer to insert their hand into the soil to assess its health, we lose perhaps the most precious aspect of having farmers among us. That is the responsibility that small farmers shoulder in monitoring and maintaining the health of their little patch of our ecosystem. Not just for the health of the agrarian world, but for the health of their own plot and their own family. Well, that sounds just lovely, Nick. What a romantic notion for the storybook farmer you have dreamt up. But, money. In my woodshop, I revel in the constant rewards I reap from learning the old ways of shaping wood with tools. In some sects of fine woodworking, the more mastery one gains, the less one requires electricity to power one's tools. Said masters are able to rely upon the finesse, achievable not only with chisel and handsaw, but with balance, leverage, and accumulated wisdom as well. As an example of this, I offer for your consideration the heroic dovetail joint. In a nutshell, dovetails are a method by which two pieces of wood may be joined together, puzzle-like, with interlocking angled fingers called pins and tails. This treatment is often found in the construction of drawer boxes and fine furniture. Traditionally, the dovetails can be cut and excavated using just a couple of simple hand tools, like a chisel, a mallet, and a dovetail saw. Freehanding this process is indeed a mark of mastery, and it requires many hours of practice, which includes the ruination of a lot of boards. The nice part is you can put on some Nick Cave or some Patty Griffin and savor the sounds and smells of cutting joinery, the same way woodworkers have been doing it for centuries. Now, if you're trying to build, say, a chest of drawers with 16 dovetails apiece in each of 5 drawers, plus another 20 dovetails in the carcass or body of the piece, for a total of 100 dovetails, you're looking at a considerable commitment of billable time, which you have undoubtedly underbid in the price you gave your client. So you get out your woodworking textbooks, or you jump on YouTube and find a few different ways to supposedly speed up the process by involving your bandsaw or table saw, and you spend a bunch of time dialing in the processes and jigs necessary to that improvement. Whether you actually save time in the long run is always questionable. But wait, there is indeed more. When you're looking for quick dovetail helpers, you can actually blow right past the saw-based tricks and into the realm of the router guide. Without getting too technical, this is basically a metal template that attaches to your board, allowing a spinning router bit, like a very large dental tool, to be guided along in and out of what looks like a series of teeth, so that the spinning cutter bit simply removes all the necessary wood and creates the dovetails very quickly. The router motor can vary in size, but joinery bits are best housed in a motor about as large as a medium coffee can. Once you have the knack of this, your dovetails can be cut much more quickly than they can with only hand tools, unless you're Christian Bexfort, the modern master of the shaker style. If dovetails were in the Olympics, he'd have several gold medals. The trade-off, as you may have guessed, is that a router motor doesn't just resemble a dental rotary tool, it actually sounds like a giant tooth drill. Between the motor and the noise of the bit cutting greedily into the wood, it's a veritable assault on the ears that even with ear protection makes me grit my teeth. The razor-sharp dovetail bit, usually between a pencil eraser and the tip of your pinky finger in size, is spinning at around 24,000 revolutions per minute, or as the young people say, hella fast. Or as their even younger counterparts DM each other, fast AF. This speed also makes this one of the most treacherous tools in the shop, but money. In so many ways that are referred to as progress, we happily leave behind such an incredible wealth of accumulated human knowledge. I know that for myself, I have learned, again and again because I am stupid and stubborn, that I would rather work in the old ways. Don't get me wrong, I drive a modern vehicle, I use a smartphone. I even plug a probe thermometer into the pork butt I'm smoking. But wherever and whenever I can, I indulge in the traditional ways that my ancestors might recognize. The thermometer might be fancy and newfangled, but the 8 pounds of smoked pork over an oak and hickory charcoal fire is downright eldritch. In fact, this brings to mind the great quote from Jonas Salk, "Our greatest responsibility is to be good ancestors." To me, this means that I want to leave, as my message to the coming generations, furniture that can be translated as knew the wood, knew the tools, knew the tree. This would be the type of message I would prefer, as opposed to the swollen landfills full of disposable but cute athletic shoes and plastic everythings. With my trademark oversimplification, I'll now swing back to James and his family, and many of the farmers with small holdings that I know who honestly aren't all that different from fine woodworkers. Fewer router-cut dovetails and less factory livestock mean fewer dollars or pounds, but they make up for it in other ways. I mean, come on. Farmers, like school teachers, should be treasured and protected vastly more than they currently are, as they are the ones who treasure and protect the growing crops that will sustain us going forward. We should be subsidizing small farmers and with funds from Homeland Security, because it is those farmers who guard our first and last best defense. Reward the families who bolster the health of our soil, our watersheds, and our communities. It makes little sense that almost anywhere in America you can find yourself driving past factory farms, which you can smell for many miles before they rear into sight, that the people engaged in that depravity should be able to earn as good a living as a farmer doing their best to cultivate healthy meat, dairy, and produce in step with Mother Nature is a pretty damning blight on our society, and it requires some pretty thick blinders to miss. But money. Chapter 11. Queen of the Belties. My second trip to Racy Gill, the Rebanks farmstead, came a few weeks after the first, in early February of 2019, and not a moment too soon. I had been shooting my sci-fi show Devs on a huge soundstage in Manchester, which housed the full-size futuristic research facility at the center of the show's narrative, a building called Devs for development. In the middle of the set's ultra-modern expanses of glass and steel floated a breathtaking sculpture that resembled, to my way of thinking, a robot spaceship jellyfish. Meticulously assembled from thousands of tiny mirrors, rods, plates, and circuits, this hypnotizing chandelier-like construction was the quantum computer hanging at the core of the building. Our scenes, which revolved around this shiny, foreign object, were as coldly dramatic and alienating as the freezing snowstorms that had moved into Manchester. The production was taking very good care of me, but my hotel fare just couldn't hold a candle to Mrs. Rebank's homegrown grass-fed beef roast. I arrived early on a Saturday and was treated to fresh eggs from their own laying hens. Now let's slow down here and give this occasion its appropriate weight, because there is nothing I love more than eggs. As is the custom on well-appointed farms in the know, the dozen or so Rebanks hens have a coop that sits on wheels so that they can be trolleyed about, then relegated to a temporarily fenced-in feeding area while they pick the delicious bugs and beetles out of the grasses and the cow and sheep dung, or muck, as they call it there in Matterdale. Then repay the section with an even spreading of their own chicken poop, which is full of nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, and calcium. Rich also in organic matter loaded with micro and macronutrients, chicken manure is actually considered a soil amendment. Let's hit pause real quick to talk about the Terry Gilliam's Brazil level of dystopian shitshow that is modern retail labeling language, specifically regarding food. Much has been made of the chicanery surrounding the terminology that starts out earnestly enough, you're organic or you're all-natural, and is then quickly and summarily co-opted by corporate interests who lobby the FDA to considerably loosen